That are close. Oh, there it goes.
Broadcasting.
Thank you. Welcome, everyone. I will call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. And will you please call the roll?
Senator Finley.
Senator Finley present by video.
Senator Riley.
Excused.
Senator Wagner.
Also excused. The two of them will be late today.
Vice Chair Boquist.
Boquist is present on audio.
And Chair Burdick.
Burdick present by video. Okay, we have four bills on for public hearing today. Chris, are the people present here for 2264? I thought about taking that first since we have so many witnesses.
I believe, I'm checking the list. Mazin, I don't know if you've checked the list.
Actually, let me correct myself. I think we'll go in order so that we can get our two other members back, since that's the bill that has the most discussion. So forget I ever said that. So we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2028.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, this is Caitlin Harker from the Legislative Revenue Office. House Bill 2028A eases the process for cities to elect to receive state shared revenues by removing a requirement for an enactment of an ordinance stating that they will do so. It adds to statute a definition of consolidated property taxes for purposes of cities receiving those state shared revenues. It establishes a timeline for DAS to determine the amount of property taxes due to cities as part of this revenue sharing. And part of the bill eliminates obsolete statutes or statute references.
Thank you. And we have signed up Adam Crawford.
Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Boquist, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Adam Crawford, here today representing the Department of Administrative Services. Committee staff hit this one on the head. House Bill 2028, which I'm here in support of today, is a relatively technical bill in nature. As the committee likely knows, other state agencies are responsible for collecting certain revenue streams into the state, be it cigarette or liquor or most recently, marijuana revenues. It is the Department of Administrative Services' responsibility to then, after those revenues are collected, to distribute them to cities as required by statutory law. Prior to doing this, however, there's a few things that cities have to do. Namely, they have to have a few public hearings so their citizens can comment on the budget. They have to collect a property tax. And finally, they have to pass an ordinance saying that they would like to receive these state shared revenues. After they have done all of these four steps, we as DAS then send them their share of revenues on a quarterly basis. However, 98% of the time, this system works perfectly well. However, it's in those cases, especially in small cities, where there is either turnover at the staff level or turnover in their city councils, that they aren't able to complete their ordinances in a required time, that this bill is specifically focused at. We would like the ability to, through either a simple attestation by either a city council or a staff member, depending upon how that city would like to do it, after they have completed that and submitted that to DAS, use that rather than an ordinance prior to submitting shared revenues. Again, this is probably not the most contentious bill you're going to hear this session, but we think it creates a meaningful and important step forward, especially for those smaller jurisdictions, to make sure that we don't run into issues and that they are able to get the revenues that they need. Happy to answer any questions. At the present time, I know of no objections to the bill, but happy to work with whomever if there are any that we find. So at this time, happy to take any questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And you are the only witness signed up, so I assume you're correct that there's no opposition to this bill that we have discovered so far. So are there questions, Mr. Crawford? Senator Finley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to say, as a former city manager who had to do this stupid ordinance every year, and as well as the budget process seemed pretty silly to me, and I'm glad to see this bill come through. Thank you, Mr. Crawford.
Thank you. I think it's really important to support our local governments anytime we can. And now that Senator Finley has validated that, I feel even more committed to it. Thank you, Adam. I have no other witnesses, so we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2028 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2131.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, House Bill 2131 changes statutes related to collection abilities of the Department of Revenue in the following areas: heavy equipment and rental taxes, state lodging taxes, emergency communication system taxes, and petroleum load fees. It specifies the timing of notices of liability, assessment payments, and appeals. It also adds to statute a list of parties that the Department of Revenue may hold accountable for the tax debt, including owners, officers, employees, or members. It allows for joint and several liability of these accountable parties for payment of taxes. It applies to amounts due as of January 1, 2022, but would take effect 91 days following adjournment sine die. And I believe that the Department of Revenue is in the room in case there are questions about specifics that might come up in the rulemaking process under this bill.
Okay, thank you. And we do have Xan Culber signed up. So do you want to just say a few words?
Thank you, Chair Burdick. Members of the committee, I am Xan Culver with the Oregon Department of Revenue. As Caitlin mentioned, the department does administer several tax and fee programs where the tax or the fee is imposed on the customer of the business, and then that business is required to collect the tax or fee and hold that in trust until it's remitted to the Department of Revenue. Unfortunately, we do have some businesses that use the money that they're required to hold in trust to pay their operating expenses instead of remitting that tax to the department. And when we don't get that revenue from those businesses, we have to pursue collection of the delinquent tax using the tools that we have available to us. For the current withholding of personal income tax and statewide transit taxes, as well as the marijuana retail tax, those are all programs where a tax is collected from someone else and is held in trust by the business on behalf of the state. Those programs, the department has authority to collect the delinquent tax from the officers, employees, or members of the business. And we determine that they're responsible, that they're personally responsible, if they had control of the funds and responsibility for reporting and remitting the tax, or the decision-making authority regarding remittance of the tax funds, and also did not remit the funds that they were holding in trust. House Bill 2131 extends that same authority to the four programs that Caitlin had mentioned. And all of those programs are required to be collected by the business and then held in trust until remitted to the department. For the three programs that I mentioned, we have the authority for already. The department has adopted administrative rules that clarify who can be held personally liable. And the rules, they require that the person be in a position of authority to pay the taxes or direct payment of the taxes at the time that the responsibility to collect and remit those taxes had occurred. The person must have been or should have been aware that the taxes were not paid, and the person's responsibilities within the business must have included the authority to hire and dismiss employees, set employee work schedules and conditions, sign or co-sign checks, compute and sign tax returns, choose to pay one creditor over another or incur debt, or make fiscal decisions on behalf of the business. So if House Bill 2131 becomes law, we will work with stakeholders to adopt similar rules for the programs that are included in the bill to clarify just who can be held personally liable for the unpaid taxes. A determination of which persons could be held personally liable for the delinquent tax owed by the business does require a thorough investigation by the department. And we engage with persons identified as potentially having responsibility to determine whether they are responsible for the unpaid tax. And then that person or persons who we identify as being liable can appeal that determination either to the department ourselves, and we do a conference process, or they can also appeal to the Oregon Tax Court. We recently heard that there are some concerns about the inclusion of employee in the list of persons that could be held personally liable. I just want to point that the language in this bill does mirror existing statutes, and that the intent is to add the collection tool to the additional programs where the tax or fee is required to be collected by the business and held in trust on behalf of the state and then remitted to the department. Only persons who have had a direct role in deciding not to remit that tax revenue to the state are assigned liability for the delinquent debt. We assign that liability judiciously and after a thorough investigation. We look at researching business registry information, employment department and tax program registration data, return filing and payment history, business licenses, and other information. The assignment of that liability is determined after review of the investigation results. So in other words, it is double checked within the department. Sometimes an owner claims that they are an employee, and through our investigation process, we find that they had control of the funds and were in a more direct role of not paying the taxes to the department. I'd like to also point out that these four programs included in House Bill 2131 are other fund programs, and the revenue from the programs goes to programs that are administered by other state agencies and local taxing districts. Today, we have about $900,000 in delinquent tax for these programs that are listed in the bill, and that debt has been assessed, but it remains uncollectible. We ask for your support in extending the existing collection tool to these programs and adopt House Bill 2131. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator Finley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Culver. You answered one of my questions, because I was going to ask how much money you think this will collect. So obviously you're probably not going to collect the full $900 million, but something less than that. But my question is, California and Washington have adopted a much more restrictive definition of a responsible person than this bill indicates, but you just indicated that it's your intent to make that narrow definition in the rules section to be compliant as others. Did I hear that correctly?
Senator Burdick, Senator Finley, that is correct. We would narrow it by administrative rule to mirror how we have it for the other programs.
And stakeholders would be involved in that rule writing process.
Senator Burdick, Senator Finley, absolutely. We will involve stakeholders across all four of those programs.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. You're the only witness signed up, so we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2131 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2521.
Yes, Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2521 comes to you from the House side, the Revenue Committee, and this bill primarily deals with the transient lodging tax. It requires that the transient lodging tax collectors, and the collectors could be either the owners who actually collect the tax, or the OTCs, the online travel companies, or the management companies who actually collect the rent and the tax, to provide an invoice or a receipt of similar document that clearly sets forth all and the sum of all transient lodging taxes charged for the occupancy of the transient lodging facility. Measure primarily is a transparency and auditing enables auditing type of measure And it comes with from a series of different measures that have been in the few past sessions that have basically dealt with these issues of transparency and the auditing and collection.
Thank you. We have signed up Representative Marsh. And I see that Senator Wagner has joined us. So Senator, Representative Marsh, are you there?
Madam Chair, we don't see her. Manny is reaching out to try and touch base with her.
Okay.
So we're not sure.
There she is.
Yep, she just popped in. Okay.
Welcome, Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. Are you ready for me?
We are ready for you.
Okay, I didn't start talking, we'll do. Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Pam Marsh. I am the House Representative for District 5, which is Southern Jackson County. Because House Bill 2521 is the most recent in a series of bills we have considered and passed over the last few years to modernize the transient occupancy tax, sometimes also called the transient lodging tax. Significant changes in the overnight accommodations industry, including the use of online portals and intermediaries, have required us to update our statutes to ensure equity between traditional providers, including hotels and motels, and new types of accommodations. House Bill 2521 is the next step in this process. Very simply, House Bill 2521 requires that transient occupancy taxes that apply to a stay are clearly listed on the bill, invoice, receipt, or other document provided to the customer. The bill has three objectives. First, we want to provide customers with a very clear and transparent account of the taxes they have paid. Second, we want to ensure that providers and intermediaries are applying taxes, including the state and any local TLTs, to all non-optional services associated with the stay. Third, we want to make sure that both state and local taxes are being collected and then submitted. In preparing this bill, I took a look at a dozen overnight accommodation listings in Ashland and Medford. The good news is that all the listings that I reviewed showed a line with taxes and fees. And the bad news is that I found significant irregularities in the accounting. Sometimes the billing listed an amount that represented just the 1.5% state tax. In other cases, it included the local tax, but not the state tax. In yet another case, it was clear from my cell phone math that the obligatory cleaning fee had been excluded from the tax calculation. Please note that House Bill 2521 does not require that state and local taxes be listed separately. Instead, they can be indicated as a sum total on the bill. But all taxes need to be included in that total so that we have some assurance that they are being applied, paid, and ultimately submitted to state and local governments. House Bill 2521 is just a simple step to support both transparency and tax enforcement. Thank you so much for the chance to present. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions, Senator Findley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Marsh and I worked on this for three different sessions in the House, so I remember this bill significantly. There, if I recall, a question that continued to come up during those discussions, and I was wondering if you had it again this year, was the ability of these companies and these portals to bring their system up to date in a timely manner to do this. There was always the discussion in the past about, well, it's going to take us years and thousands of dollars to upgrade our systems to allow to display this. Is that issue been resolved, Representative? Is it still out there? Is the timelines workable for these folks?
I think the timeline is workable. Chair Burdick, Senator Findley, can you still hear me? I feel like I'm freezing up.
We can still hear you.
Okay, I'm freezing up on my end. I'm going to turn off my camera. I think they do have that capability. And in fact, many of them have tax lines that are delineated on their forms. We did get some entities who said they didn't want to pull out state and local separately, and we agree to that. But it's really critical that the taxes be delineated, be clear, These are taxes that are being held in trust by these entities. They're being collected. We need to be able to, when we go back to enforce, to validate that they were collected, that they were held, and to make sure that they are then turned in to those of us who are looking for them. And of course, it's also a big equity issue. If hotels and motels can do this, then the intermediaries, and I understand that there are more than 100 intermediaries of various kinds serving customers in the state, should be able to do it as well.
Follow up,
please.
Thank you. And who do these receipts go to? Are they for the guest or the occupant, and with a copy to the state, or how does that process going to work and flow?
Thank you, Chair Burdick, Senator Finley. The receipts are really for the customer. So if I have an overnight stay, I can look at that and I can see, well, I paid for the room, I paid for the cleaning, I paid for my internet, which was obligatory. And then there is a tax that's applied to all of those services, the basic stay plus the obligatory services. So it's a transparency issue for the customer, but it's also an audit item for the state or local community. If we need to, and the State Department of Revenue has talked about needing powers to go and double check that taxes held in trust are really being collected and turned in. It's another way of assuring that those taxes are being collected. You know, this has just been, as I said in my opening remarks, kind of the next chapter in what can we do to make sure that there's a fair playing field among all these entities.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Representative Marsh.
Thank you so much.
We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2521 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2264.
Yes, Senator Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2264 comes to you in the A version. I went through the Committee on General Government on the House, and that's the House, and it reaches you in this format. And the bill in general addresses five different issues. Four of them are very technical in nature, in the sense it allows the OLCC, or the issue one allows OLCC to negotiate price with Indian tribes and commercial airlines in the sale of distilled liquor. And the other one allows for the identification to be accepted when it comes from the territory or province in Canada with certain specification. Third one will be to authorize nonprofit and charitable organization registered for the state to sell alcohol for up to 45 days in a calendar year with a license. And the fourth technical issue is the measure that allows manufacturers and wholesalers to lease or furnish equipment no more than 14 days of a reasonable period. The issue that kind of entangles and becomes part of the revenue and a taxation issue, which is the fifth issue of this bill, is the issue of changing the definition of what the malt beverage is. And by changing this definition, it allows for products to be substituted in the manufacturing or in the refining process, and allows for those new products to be classified in a malt beverage type of way, which makes them eligible or subject to the rate of taxation that is due to malt beverage or beer. And the otherwise, at this time, those products are fall in the definition of what wine is. And wine and beer, of course, are taxed differently at different rates. And if that is the case, they would be subject to a higher tax rate where the wine tax rate is. In addition, the bill also changes the definition of a dessert wine. A dessert wine in statutes are defined to be the alcohol by volume, and that primarily is raised up from 14% to 16%. And the difference and the importance for that change, because alcohol by volume or the dessert wine is taxed with an additional 10 cents that does not apply to regular wine. So these differences in the definition is where the this issue touches which product is taxed under which regime of taxation.
Senator Finley, did you have a question before we move to our witnesses?
I do. I was just curious. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mazen, since we're going to be changing classifications, you're going to go from wines to malts and ales, which will, has there been a revenue impact? What would the additional revenue to the state be for the implementation of this bill? It sounds like some of the dessert wines are going to go to regular wines, which would lower it, but some of these others will go from a wine to an ale, which would significantly increase their taxes. So what is the impact of that?
So the two issues, Senator. The first one is that the change in the dessert wine, and that's going from the 14% to 16%. And to be, we're all honesty on this, we have not finished what we call an investigation on what is the space that would change that subject. So we, and the revenue impact that we've issued before, it's indeterminate because we really don't know that issue extremely well yet. The other one, which is changing or allowing for these new products to be taxed on the beer rate rather than on the wine rate. These are new products that are coming, and it basically would subject them to lower tax rate rather than higher tax rate. So it will bring down their tax rate. And these are a number of products that OLCC, until we've talked lately, they were still researching this issue and how much. These are some of them as the products are becoming very popular. You're talking about the White Claw and the Truly and that good stuff, which I found very appealing because, you know, I have to use them because it's my job, right?
Thank goodness for that. So.
Yeah. So those under the definitions of today might be or could be, at least we know about one of these products that if it goes and it becomes defined as beer and taxed as beer, it approximately would have something in the neighborhood of about a reduction of about $2.5 to $3 million. But the whole universe of how many others, it's at least probably double that. But we don't have a complete grasp before OLCC is able to actually finish the research on the issue and give us a definite size of the market that we are dealing with. And that's behind our indeterminate type of revenue impact at this time.
Okay. Let's get going with our witnesses here. We'll start out with Danelle Romaine. Danelle, do I see you here? There you are.
Burdick, can you see me? Okay. Yeah. Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and Vice Chair Boquist and members of the committee. Danelle Romaine here representing the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. And it might be more useful actually to have the OLCC go first to talk about kind of the process we've gone through on this bill, but I'd be happy to kind of give my two cents here and maybe they're...
Why don't we do that? That occurred to me, and I usually try to take an advocate first, but if you're comfortable with OLCC going first, I think that'd be very productive. Okay. So we'll start off with Steve Marks.
Thank you. For the record, Steve Marks, Executive Director of OLCC. Thank you. I'll speak to the whole bill, but come back to the federal classification. So I'd like to start out with the tribal piece. Just want to understand, we worked on that for last session, had agreement with the tribes to move forward, and this affirms our old relationship of providing distilled liquor to tribes at cost plus 5% on the cases. So very much in agreement and appreciate you affirming that in statute. As well, there are provisions here that allow us to service the airline industry that uses Portland for restocking their planes, and this authority will give us the opportunity to service that airline business in Portland with the minis made for airlines, which will contribute. This year, its fiscal impact's gone down. Airlines aren't flying as much, so we're about $500,000. It was $1 million, $1.2 million in February last year when we brought it back. So we expect that to contribute a little bit more in the future. We've worked with Representative Gomberg, as Mazin noted, on the Canadian ID issue. We had extended that by rule to our Canadian friends, but we think this statutory affirmation is a very good thing for Oregon. You would find it, maybe you wouldn't, very believable that Canadians are very upset when they come to Oregon and their ID is not recognized at our liquor establishments and bars and restaurants. And then we aligned and worked on nonprofits in a COVID environment to sort of extend the period and days nonprofits could move forward with fundraising and being able to sell liquor products. So we extended that to 45 days in the calendar year that they could do it. So it helped with a virtual venue if you were doing that, and you could do it over a period of time. And as well as making clear that we've removed the charge for the application fee for those nonprofits. So this would still be something they could do in a more challenging environment. And then last, of course, we are proposing to align with the federal standards for beer and wine definitions. We've worked with industry on this, looking for solutions. Part of the reason, Senator Finley, that it's indeterminate is because this is a whole forensics process and doing a post-mortem. These products come in, we've had a paper process. Now we've got to try to figure out, how was it made? How was it formulated? Even though it's the same ABV as a beer product, or if it's an ABV as a wine product, that makes it clear too. But this forensics piece is the part that causes trouble in understanding it. And that with these new product innovation, you know, it is there is an impact in here. I think I explained we have new market entries, but making us do a lab analysis to figure out what its tax rate is when the federal government has done a formula and approved it either as beer or as wine would create an enormous efficiency in our system, an enormous, I think, market aid to the industry itself, because they know what the tax rate is. And, you know, they have great latitude on formulations, you know, so they can change where they want to be in the market by what they want to create and make. So we'd commend this as a policy issue and an efficiency issue for certainty. What the market does with it, what products it brings forward, is yet to be seen with the new innovations we have out there. But this gives us a process to tax it fairly and efficiently based on the federal government. Oregon's the only outlier out there. I'm on a National Conference of State Liquor Administrators, and I got on the panel on beer and wine taxation because I'm an outlier, and I'd sure like to report to them this summer that we're not anymore, that we have an efficient way to be able to do that. So with that, we have Dan Croy here, if the committee has our specialists on alcohol, to be able to answer any questions about the technical aspects otherwise of the legislation, but would appreciate your favorable action on it. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Wagner, you have a question?
Yeah, no, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think, Mr. Marks, you probably answered this question in the course of your explanation here, but I just wanted to clarify. So this bill passed 57-0 through the House. And when I read the proposed revenue impact statement that comes with it, it looks like it's really highly indeterminate and really predicated on some hypotheticals. And so it could, I guess, there is apparently a stated risk, but it's very, I mean, really, truly the definition of indeterminate in terms of what actually might be the revenue impact. My understanding is, since you have experience in other states, why wouldn't those sort of be able to be a little bit easier to understand how we would land this here in Oregon as it relates to our taxation? I'm pleased to see, when I actually read through the revenue impact statement, that it says that it's indeterminate, because I think that's actually going to be a course of some conversation. But to me, I'm just trying to understand how I square the indeterminacy of this with the fact that you've got all this experience at the national level.
Chair Burdick, Senator Wagner, thank you for the question. So I haven't had that question, but let me take a crack at, I think, what I know about it, and maybe if we need to go further, maybe Dan Croy can help me out. I think that's because they know where they're taxed, right? And they go in there. What we're trying to determine is, in Oregon's specific system, where they would fall. And one of the things that you don't know is we've been on a paper system for some time. So a lot of this, we learn when we do the audits back through the books, and then we come up on a product and it says, oh, this is maybe one of those products that's made with too many sugars or something, or corn sugar or another. And then we got to look and figure out where it is. We are in the process now of looking back and seeing these products that have come into market through the audits. So we can't truly tell you what the nexus is on taxes currently. With our new privilege tax system, we would certainly, if it had counted all these products before and we had a category form, we could see them and tell you exactly what they are. That's going to be go forward current basis with full categories. If you created that category in the future and they had to go do it, I could tell you. But this is sort of a postmortem forensic analysis to figure how much of that maybe improperly labeled product is in our tax system. And so we're right now, we will be having to rectify some of those tax issues that showed up from the audits. This will fix that problem on a go forward basis. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Senator Boquist.
Let me take a stab at restating what I think Senator Wagner's question is. Because it's my question too. If we're the 50th outlier, is there not one of the other states that we can't reach out to and say, as the example that Mazen said he drinks, which is White Claw, that they don't have, they have not already resolved the definition of all these things, and we can't get that from like the state of Washington or the state of Idaho or one of our neighbors?
Chair Burdick, Senator Boquist, thank you for the question. They already tax that at a terminal rate of beer or wine. They're clear in the other states. We're the only state that is unclear. If that is an answer. So we can say they're all clearly taxed. They all rely on the federal definition primarily, or either by statute or by convention. And so I could look and see what their market share is in there, and that might be helpful information in differentiating what we have. But we couldn't tell you what Oregon's market share of these products is right now concurrently, because we're doing the process of looking back through the audits and finding out what's improperly classified for Oregon that was properly classified under the tobacco, TTB Bureau's process. These would be beers primarily. But that's, I hope that answered your question, Senator.
Senator Wagner, did you have another question? Okay.
No, ma'am.
Isn't part of the problem that other states have, you know, there's a definition question, but there's also the tax system. And other Oregon's tax system is different from other states. Isn't that where the problem arises in trying to figure out what a revenue impact is?
Yes, because our taxation system, Chair Burdick, yes, because our taxation is differentiates, right, between beer and wine based on the product mix and what it is, but the federal categorization doesn't provide for that. So often there's market confusion. Someone's got a label, their label's approved as a beer and TTB, and even for people who do, the wholesalers that do the work in our state of distributing those products, might not have all the direct information of exactly how it's made, so it gets categorized as a beer inside our system as products are. I'd also want to note just in this, because everyone thinks this is a downside, lose revenue potential issue. I'm not sure that's true because of the reformulation possibilities here and because of the changes to the federal tax rate. We'll provide some room at that top end of the wine category for other market entries into Oregon, so other product entries into that category.
Okay, and the consequence of not doing this, not having a consistent system with the federal system is what? Being out by ourselves.
We will have market uncertainty for the taxation rate until we do an investigation with TTB on it. And I understand even some of these products we're talking about now where you think there's one formula and it's perfectly clear what it is. There's many formulas of some of the same products on the market that are labeled under a specific brand. So it is a, you know, it'll be a forensic process for us to figure out where they are. We can communicate better with the industry leading in about what it is, and we can work with the, you know, privileged tax collection system to try to create clear categories. But it is, you know, we're only doing all of that work to figure out what side of the line it falls on for taxation. At values that are the same ABV for that product, alcohol by volume. So.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. Maybe you could stand by or have your experts stand by in case we have other technical questions. So we'll go back to the beginning of our sign-up list for Danielle Romain, and thank you for yielding your time. I think it's been helpful to hear from OLCC. So welcome, Danielle.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Happy to be here. Danielle Romain again, for the record, representing the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. Here in support of House Bill 2264, I want to put a quick plug in for Section 13, which nobody cares about except for us and the Brewers Guild. And it's totally non-controversial. It's about leasing equipment for beer festivals. And it lengthens the time that you can lease equipment. That's one of the things that's in our law. You can only lease right now for 10 days. It changes the provision to 14 days. It is quite important, and we'd like to see support for that change. So thank you for that. Section 4 is quite important, the definition of malt beverage. This aligns Oregon's definition with the federal Internal Revenue Code definition of what is a malt beverage. That is how, if you're a producer of beer, you get licensed by both the TTB at the federal level and you get licensed by the state of Oregon. That's true of wine too. So you have to determine what you are. Are you a brewer or are you a winery? Your license, you know, you can do what you can do under your specific license. If we were to call these products, these seltzers, a wine, and they're being made by a brewer, all those brewers would now need a new license, both federally and in the state of Oregon. And we'd be the only state, as Director Marks just said, the only state in the country to say these seltzers are a wine. It doesn't make any sense. It creates an administrative nightmare for the OLCC. The OLCC, as Steve just said, would have to literally audit every seltzer you see on your grocery store shelf, get their formula from the TTB, which is a whole process and a very expensive process for the state to determine that if they were not meeting our definition. Instead, it is better just to have consistency with the rest of the country here and consistency with the way these products are taxed and are licensed under the federal government. And they've all been paying the beer tax, so it's not like these products have not been paying a tax. They've all assumed, because they're licensed as a brewer, that they have been paying the beer tax. So not until OLCC went back and looked at this kind of missing part of Oregon's definition did they say, oh, shoot, actually, you know, we might be you might be paying the wrong tax on these products. And so it's really critical that we do fix this. The issue of reformulation is real. We've seen that happen in the past. I don't know if you remember, back in the day, the Bartles and James wine coolers reformulated and became malt-based. And they did that because so they could be taxed as a beer. So that does happen. So the idea that we could gain some new revenue by taxing these products as a wine is not a real issue, because if you're a large producer out of state, you're going to reformulate, because there's no way, you know, you're going to be taxed as a wine if you don't need to be. That'll be much harder for the Oregon producers, and there are quite a few of them, of these products, to just reformulate. That's why this is so critical to them, and I know the Oregon Brewers Guild is here to speak to that issue. So happy to answer any questions. This was a totally non-controversial bill on the House side. It passed 57-0. It's quite important, and really ask for your support here. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? See no questions. So we'll move to Mia Noren from the Oregon Wine Growers Association.
Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Boquist, and members of the committee, I'm Mia Noren, representing the Oregon Wine Growers Association. OWA has been advocating for Oregon's wine industry for more than 40 years. We represent hundreds of winery and vineyards, small and large, throughout the state. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2264, which seeks to address several technical issues related to alcohol laws. OWA supports the provision that aligns state statute with the Federal Craft Modernization Act by changing the wine privilege tax lower tier rate from 14 to 16% alcohol by volume. Consistency with revised federal law will make the record keeping and reporting requirements easier to administer for Oregon wineries, as well as help them to budget. It will also make it much easier for the OLCC to audit and double check tax payments. OWA supported this change on the federal level and therefore asked the committee to pass House Bill 2264. Thank you, and I'm here to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Norum? Okay, see no questions. So next we'll take Phil Donovan.
Hello. For the record, Phil Donovan. And with your indulgence, as this is an omnibus bill, Madam Chair, I'd like to speak on behalf of two clients. And if I could start with the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla.
Please do.
Thank you. So as you heard, House Bill 2264 authorizes the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to sell distilled liquor to Indian tribes holding a full on-premise liquor license at a price negotiated by the OLCC and the tribe. C2IR and OLCC entered a memorandum of understanding in January of 2006. The purpose of the memorandum of understanding was to establish how Oregon liquor laws and OLCC licensing regulations would apply to Wild Horse Resort and any other entity that the C2R would permit to sell and serve alcohol on the reservation. The MOU also contains a provision permitting the C2R to purchase distilled liquor from the OLCC warehouse at prices specified in the MOU. C2R and our Wild Horse Resort have fully complied with the MOU for the past 15 years. This has created an effective working relationship on the important issue of regulating alcohol sales and service. And this is a very important bill, and we request your support for this particular provision. And then if I could take off my Umatilla Tribes hat and put on my Miletus Beverage hat, Phil Donovan, to say that Miletus Beverage is a family-owned distributor serving the Portland metropolitan region. And we would greatly appreciate the cleanup in statute clarifying how hard seltzers are taxed. We distribute Bud Light Seltzer, and to have it be taxed as wine would be quite odd. As you know, and I've heard, the tax has been paid on malt beverage, or the tax has been paid on these products, and they're not that new. You know, I mean, everybody knows White Claw truly, and the tax impact. We would greatly appreciate some consistency in the Oregon revised statute with the federal definitions. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Donovan? I see no questions, so we'll move to Christine LaRue.
Hi, good afternoon. Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Great, thank you. Madam Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Boquist, and esteemed committee members, my name is Christina LaRue, and I am the Executive Director of the Oregon Brewers Guild. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2264, which passed the House without opposition in a 57-0 vote last month. The Guild, as well as representatives across the alcohol sector, have spent months working through the fine details of this bill with the OLCC to ensure that we are all in agreement with the language. House Bill 2264 includes multiple OLCC technical fixes that will be beneficial to the Oregon craft brewing industry, our members. Canadian driver's license. This bill will allow the Canadian driver's licenses to be included as an approved form of identification to purchase alcohol here in Oregon. In my years of working on the brew pub side of the business, I can tell you I had plenty of Canadians that we had to turn away from purchasing alcohol because they did not have their passport on hand. And it was extremely frustrating for not only the guest, but myself and the staff, as well as a loss of sales. The nonprofit charitable organization temporary sales licensing piece, the bill will allow for nonprofits, and charitable organizations such as the Oregon Brewers Guild, the ability to sell alcohol up to 45 days in a calendar year. For the Guild, this change will mean the ability to still generate income outside of any in-person events that may or may not happen this year. We have had a substantial loss in revenue over the past 14 months due to restrictions and the inability to hold in-person events. We are still uncertain if our largest annual event, our Portland Fresh Hop Festival, will take place this fall. Having the ability to sell items such as specialty beer box raffles or collaboration project beers via our website would be extremely helpful. Equipment rentals. The bill will also extend the period that a manufacturer or wholesaler can rent out equipment such as draft trailers up to 14 days from the current 10-day max. This will be extremely helpful for events such as our beer festival, the Portland Fresh Hop Fest, that are held over multiple days and or weekends and would have the need of that specialty equipment for longer durations. And finally, the malt beverage definition. The bill would simply align the current Oregon definition of malt beverage with the federal definition, which in turn would bring much needed clarity for what ingredients are allowed as substitutions for malt. For brewers looking for alternative ingredients for products, for example, gluten-free beer, the revised definition would allow for rice, molasses, and different grains. It will also bring much needed clarity and consistency for those brewers that are manufacturing hard seltzers. Sugar will also be included as a substitute for malt, which it is on the federal definition, and would place those products fermented with sugar or glucose under the malt beverage definition. This would align with the federal definition, and has already stated, no other state defines these products as wine. We truly appreciate your support with this bill. I thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions from the Madam Chairperson or the committee members.
Okay, questions from the committee. I see no questions, so we'll move to Jonathan Manton.
Thank you so much, Chair Burdick and Vice Chair Boquist and members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Manton, and I'm here also on behalf of the Oregon Brewers Guild. So I'll be very brief and just kind of maybe making a point or two here to supplement Christina's excellent testimony. You know, as we've spoken about a few times this session, it's been a really tough year for our craft brew industry. Breweries and brew pubs and tasting rooms all across the state have suffered a lot of job losses, similar to so many others, the hospitality industry, the restaurant industry. And the provisions that Christine outlined in this bill, we're thankful for. It's going to take us a long time to recover. So you know, these are little things that hopefully make a big difference when they add up. But we're in a rough spot. And so I just wanted to kind of share that context. I want to thank OLCC because we, as was mentioned, we did some extensive negotiations and really worked hard over on the House side for the first months of this session to make sure we had these provisions that work well for the agency. And Rosie and Dan Croy and Director Marks were just really helpful throughout this process to go back and forth to make sure we get it right. I guess just the last point I'll make on the question of the beer versus the wine categorization of these seltzers. I kind of started at looking at it from like a very just layman's terms, and I'm far from a connoisseur when it comes to wine. But what little I do know is that wine comes from grapes, and what we're talking about here are malted sugar, or whether it be from malted corn or from malted cane sugar. That's different than grapes. And so for me, it's just kind of the layman's terms. Like these, there's a reason why all the country treats these beverages as beer. They're not coming from grapes. And just finally, that the standard practice has been for these seltzer companies have been paying the beer tax. And so if this definition is adopted, it will just basically in practice lead to the continuation of the revenues that were coming in on the beer tax. So we don't think it would actually result in a loss of revenue. And the complication that would have to come from the agency to deal with it would probably have a fiscal impact as well. But it certainly lead others to comment on that. And we just appreciate your support and work on this legislation.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? No questions. Our last witness is Elizabeth Howe.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Elizabeth Howe, here representing Molson Coors. Going last means that everything I say has already been said. So I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2264A, particularly Section 4, which aligns Oregon's definition of hard seltzer with the federal definition under the malt beverage category. In addition to our well-known beer brands, Coors and Miller Lite, Molson Coors has multiple hard seltzer products, including Coors Seltzer, Vizzy, and Topo Chico Hard Seltzer. We sell our products across the country, and all states tax seltzer as a beer, regardless of the fact that some are made with ingredients other than grain. The federal definition of beer allows for certain substitutes for malt, including sugar, which is a common ingredient in seltzers. But Oregon's definition casts a potential interpretation that these products are a wine. No other state taxes these as a wine. They tax these products as a beer. If Oregon does not change their definition of beer, they would be the only state to say these are a wine for tax purposes. Additionally, as Ms. Romaine noted, alcohol producers are licensed at the federal level and at the state level. An alcohol producer needs to decide if they are licensed as a winery or a brewery, both federally and in Oregon. So if a producer has a federal Alcohol and Tobacco Tax and Trade Bureau license as a brewer, but Oregon says they are now producing a wine, they likely need both a new federal license as well as multiple state licenses to produce their products. This would be very burdensome and is certainly unnecessary. House Bill 2264A presents a simple fix to maintain the industry standard that hard seltzers are defined as a beer and taxed as such. Thanks.
Thank you. So you did say new stuff, even though everything had been said. Thank you. Questions from the committee? I see no questions. So, and I believe we have no other witnesses signed up. So we will close the hearing on House Bill 2264. And that completes our business. Chris, is there anything else we need to do before we adjourn?
No, ma'am, you completed your agenda.
Okay, thank you. And with that, we are adjourned.